Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Further stories from Lord Halifax. Warning for a submarine. Francis Cadogan wrote to Lord Halifax that this story was general knowledge among the senior submarine officers and was told me by the officer commanding the Mediterranean Flotilla in 1919. Among the commanders of submarines operating during the war from the southeast coast of England was an officer whom we call Ryan, a man of striking appearance and charming personality, a great favorite in the mess of the depot ship, the sort of fellow who made everybody present cheer up when he came on the scene. It was the custom for these vessels to leave for an observation patrol of from 2 to 3 weeks' length, usually off the Dutch shoals and the entrance to Jade Bay. They worked on the surface at night, but in the daytime, owing to the numerous German aircraft patrols, they were generally submerged, coming up at intervals to have a good look around through their periscopes. Ryan's ship left on one of these cruises, and when she never returned, it was taken for granted that she had met with bad luck and been sunk, either by the Germans or by some accident. Some 7 or 8 weeks later, another submarine was operating in a similar fashion and on approximately the same beat as Ryan's. She was proceeding at slow speed and had just broken surface with her periscope, through which at the time the second in command was observing. Care was necessary, since to emerge even to this extent had been proved from experience to be a dangerous and often a fatal hazard. It was a bright sunny day, and as the officer was searching the seas with his periscope, he was heard suddenly to cry out, "By Jove! There's jolly old Ryan waving to us like mad from the water!" He immediately blew the tanks to bring the submarine to the surface, the commander and all aboard feeling that it was worth while to take a risk. Some of the men crowded into the conning tower and out on the deck with lifelines, while others stayed below and prepared restoratives for Ryan when he should have been rescued. But when the submarine came up, still keeping a little away on, not a sign of Ryan was to be seen, though the day was quite clear and a thorough search was made. Yet the officer was quite positive that it was Ryan whom he had seen, and no one doubted him. Ryan was a man of such distinctive appearance that a mistake could hardly have been made, nor had there been lately any talk of him to set imaginations at work. After a short while, an object was discerned in the sea right ahead and on the course the submarine was steering. As she came up with it, it resolved itself into two mines, which the submarine would undoubtedly have struck if Ryan had not waved to warn her off. The Tweeny. This story and the prior one were sent in 1920 by Commander Francis Cadogan, grandson of the 5th Earl Cadogan, who was at Eton with Lord Halifax. Mrs. Chilton, the real name, is a little different. The wife of a captain in the Navy and a very sensible, matter-of-fact sort of person, took a couple of rooms on the 3rd floor of a tall house near Palmerston Road, Southsea. Her husband was away at sea at the time, but as she went out a good deal and had a latchkey, she asked the landlady not to trouble to wait up for her. Nevertheless, for a time, the woman disregarded her request, and when Mrs. Chilton returned for the night, she would find the landlady sitting up for her, coming forward with a candle and insisting on escorting her upstairs. One night, however, the landlady was not there. Mrs. Chilton returned about 12:30, let herself in, found and lit a candle, and started upstairs. When she was about halfway up the dogleg stair flight, she had a feeling that someone was following her, and looking round and down, she saw it was apparently a small tween maid. As she had never noticed her about the place before, and it was rather strange that she should be up and about at that time of night, Mrs. Chilton hurried on to the next flight of stairs. When she got there, she looked around, and there was the tween just behind her. Mrs. Chilton, now turned right round, holding the candle well before her to confront the girl, who clutched the banister with her hands, and sinking nearly to her knees, gave an imploring look. Mrs. Chilton, by now a little frightened, scurried on up to her room, and neither saw nor heard any more that night. Next day, when she questioned her landlady, she was given the most unsatisfactory answers, and decided to leave the lodgings at once. Subsequently, she heard that other people who had stayed there had uncanny experiences, and that the house was known to have a bad name. The Bloody Hand. In a certain village on the south coast, a widow and her two daughters were living in a house standing rather apart from its neighbors on either side. It was situated on a wooded cliff, and about a quarter of a mile from the garden was a waterfall of some height. The two daughters were much attached to each other. One of them, Mary, was a very good-looking and attractive. Among her admirers, there were two men, especially distinguished for their devotion to her, and one of them, John Bondes, seemed on the point of realizing the ambition of his life, when a new competitor of a very different disposition appeared and completely conquered Mary's heart. The day was fixed for the marriage, but though Mary wrote to the Bondes to announce her engagement and to ask John to be present at her wedding, no reply was received from him. On the evening before the day, Ellen, the other sister, was gathering ferns in the woods when she heard a faint rustling behind her and, turning quickly round, thought she had a momentary glimpse of the figure of John Bondes. But whoever it was vanished swiftly in the twilight. On her return to the house, she told her sister what she thought she had seen, but neither of them thought much of it. The marriage took place next day. Just before the bride was due to leave with her husband, she took her sister to the room they had shared, the window of which opened onto a balcony from which a flight of steps led down to an enclosed garden. After a few words, Mary said to her sister, "I would like to be alone for a few minutes. I will join you again presently." Ellen left and went downstairs, where she waited with the others. When half an hour had passed and Mary had not appeared, her sister went up to see if anything had happened to her. The bedroom door was locked. Ellen called, but had no answer. She called again more loudly. There was still no answer. Becoming alarmed, she ran downstairs and told her mother. At last the door was forced open, but there was no trace of Mary in the room. They went into the garden, but except for a white rose lying on the path, nothing was to be seen. For the rest of that day, and on the following days, they hunted high and low. The police were called in, the whole countryside was roused, but all to no purpose. Mary had utterly disappeared. The years passed by. The mother and Mary's husband were dead, and of the wedding party only Ellen and an old servant were left. One winter's night, the wind rose to a furious gale and did a great deal of damage to the trees near the waterfall. When the workmen came in the morning to clear away the fallen timber and fragments of rock, they came upon a skeleton hand, on the third finger of which was a wedding ring guarded by another ring with a red stone on it. On searching further, they found the complete skeleton, round whose dried-up bones some rags of cloth still adhered. The ring with a red stone in it was identified by Ellen as one which her sister was wearing on her wedding day. The skeleton was buried in the churchyard, but the shock of the discovery was so great that a few weeks later Ellen herself was on her deathbed. On the occasion of Mary's burial, she had insisted on keeping the skeleton hand with the rings, putting it in a glass box to secure it from accident, and now, when she lay dying, she left the relic to the care of her old servant. Shortly afterwards, the servant set up a public house, whereas, may be imagined, the skeleton hand and its story were a common topic of conversation among those who frequented the bar. One night, a stranger muffled up in a cloak and with a cap pulled over his face, made his way into the inn and asked for something to drink. It was a night like this when the great oak was blown down, the publican observed to one of his customers. "Yes," the other replied, and it must have made the skeleton seem doubly ghastly, discovering, as it were, in the midst of ruins. "What skeleton?" asked the stranger, turning suddenly from the corner in which he had been standing. "Oh, it's a long story," answered the publican. "You can see the hand in that glass case, and if you like, I will tell you how it came there." He waited for an answer, but none came. The stranger was leaning against the wall in a state of collapse. He was staring at the hand, repeating again and again, "Blood, blood," and sure enough, blood was slowly dripping from his fingertips. A few minutes later, He had recovered sufficiently to admit that he was John Bodney's, and to ask that he might be taken to the magistrates. To them he confessed that in a frenzy of jealousy, he had made his way into the private garden on Mary's wedding day. Seeing her alone in her room, he had entered and seized her, muffling her cries, and had taken her as far as the waterfall. There she had struggled so violently to escape from him that unintentionally he had pushed her off the rocks, and she had fallen into a cleft where she was almost completely hidden. Afraid of being discovered, he had not even waited to find out whether she was dead or alive. He had fled and had lived abroad ever since, until an overpowering longing led him to revisit the scene of his crime. After making his confession, Bodney's was committed to the county jail, where shortly afterward he died before any trial could take place. The Rustling Lady of Lincoln and Other Stories. Miss Nash, a lady in India, sent the following stories to the present Lord Halifax. My grandfathers each had a prophetic dream. My father's father, Dr. Nash, one of those whom Dean Church, in his book in the Oxford Movement, called the precursors of that revival, had been in Scotland and intended to start on his return journey by coach on the following day. During the night he dreamed that the coach capsized and that all the outside passengers, of whom he meant to be one, were killed. So vivid was the dream that he put off his journey. The coach was wrecked and all the outside passengers were killed. My mother's father, after leaving school, was offered by the father of a schoolfellow a clerkship in the Linen Hall in Dublin. He accepted it to the indignation of his own father, who probably wanted him to sit down and bemoan the folly of his grandfather in running through his property and leaving his family a paltry £200 a year on which to live. One night, my grandfather dreamed that he was sent to the bank for money, a duty which, as he was a junior clerk, he had never been given before, and that while he was there, a man came in and presented a check, the signature on which he knew in his dream to be forged. He whispered his information to the cashier. The man was detained, and the forgery was discovered. Next day, all happened as in the dream. The young clerk was sent to the bank. The man came in with a check, and he presented it to the cashier next to my grandfather. Almost involuntarily, the latter whispered the information that the signature had been forged, and so it turned out to have been, my grandfather gaining much kudos. But he used to say that he would never forget the terror which swept over him when he realized that on the flimsy evidence of a dream, he had brought a serious charge against a complete stranger. My father was for 10 years in Western Australia, where at one time he was looking after his brother's station up country. Mr. X, a settler in the district who had been doing well, often spoke of going home for a holiday, so that no one was surprised when another friend riding over to CX was told by the overseer that he had gone for 2 years, leaving him in charge. Shortly afterwards, however, the same friend happened to pass by again and was greatly astonished to see X sitting on a fence. "Hello, X," he called out. "I thought you had gone home." The other made no reply but got down from the fence, walked a short distance away, and apparently vanished. The friend, after discussing this experience with some of the neighbors, returned to the place with some native trackers who examined the place and reported, "White man's brains." They then followed the tracks to the spot where X had disappeared and said, "Dies." A little below the surface of the ground, the body of Mr. X was found. The overseer was arrested, and of course everyone, including my father and my Uncle Richard, went to the trial. At first the man protested his innocence, but when the story of the appearance of X and the finding of the body was related, he confessed in open court. He said he thought he would have 2 years in which to feather his nest and before he need disappear. Both my father and my uncle were present when the murderer confessed, and the above is their account. Canon Charles Gray of Redford and Blythe, Notts, told us that his brother, who was a solicitor to the York chapter, once lived in an old house in the close. He had a small son, and soon after they had moved into their house, the child began to talk of my old gentleman, who visited him in the nursery when no one else was there. At first they thought he was imagining or dreaming, but he was so sure of what he had seen that the father, after getting from the child as well as he could a description of the old man, went to the cathedral library to inquire into the history of the house. He found that it had once been inhabited by the uncle of Lawrence Stern, and a portrait in the library showed him dressed just as the child had described. That one time we lived in Lincoln. My Uncle Perry was at Waddington, 4 miles away on Lincoln Cliff. He married my mother's sister and wrote a student's church history and other books. 4 miles further along the cliff was Harmston, and I remember as a child, when staying at Waddington, going for a walk to Harmston Hall and thinking what a desolate place it looked. The owner, a crony, I think, of George IV, had fled the country for some unknown reason, and the place was in chancery. Some years later, when we went to Lincoln, I used to go out once a week to Waddington to study Latin and early English with Uncle Perry. One day, he told me that long ago, he had been over to Harmston as a witness, I think when officials opened the room, which had been locked by the wicked squire when he fled 30 years before. Nothing much had been done while he lived abroad, and Uncle Perry said the room looked as if the guests had suddenly jumped up from the table, chairs had been knocked over, glasses were lying on the floor. There were moldy, dusty remains of food, all as if something frightening had happened. The story was that the squire suddenly informed the company that his wife had run away with his best friend, sent them all off, locked up the room, and went abroad the next day. Uncle Perry, however, said it looked more as though something dreadful had caused their flight. However, it may have been neither friend nor wife was ever heard of again. My sister had started a school in Lincoln, and I, being just trained and about to be given the headship of a high school, had to give up everything and join the others in Lincoln. While we were there, two of the boarders, nice girls, daughters of a gentleman farmer living at Harmston, once asked Em and me to come out to tea in the holidays. We went for a long afternoon and found they were living in Harmston Hall, as the farmer was farming the land. The mother told us that the house was haunted, though she had no idea of it when she went there. The first night, just when the clock in the hall struck 11, she heard a loud shriek of terror and someone rushed down the passage and fell against the door. She thought one of the children had been frightened by a dream in the strange house and ran to the door and opened it, but there was no one there. Every night as 11 struck, the same thing happened, and she got quite used to it. I, thinking of old stones, asked, why did they not raise the hearthstone of that room? It seems they never thought of doing that, and anyhow, it had all happened years before. Perhaps the wife and friend of the old squire were murdered and buried under the hearthstone of the locked room. The old squire's son came back and lived and died in a Waddington cottage, regarded as uncanny by people, I believe. Several people tried to live in the hall, but it was never long before they left. One manufacturer made a good many alterations to the house, but his wife went out of her mind, and they departed. At last, the old owner died, and the place was sold to a Lincoln iron founder. I do not know how he got on, or if there were any more appearances. My sister had been told that the house she had taken in Lincoln was haunted, but none of us, nor of the servants, knew this till after we had left. It was built in 1107, and the lower part was Roman brickwork, roughly reshaped, a lovely place. My mother turned a small room, entered by two steps down into a bathroom. There was a long corridor leading to the paneled drawing room. A passage ran west, passing one bedroom and on the other side the bathroom, and ending in a large bedroom with a powdering closet off it. Beyond it was a small room in which I slept, and a flight of stairs went up to the servants' bedroom and down to the oldest part where M, my eldest sister, was sleeping. Soon after we had moved in, N, the youngest of us, said to me, "Alice, I wish you would sit on the bathroom steps and talk to me when I'm there." She and I took our baths that night. We laughed, but I did as she asked. One night, in the holidays, I was in the bathroom, and everyone else was in bed, when I heard someone with rustling skirts run past the bathroom door and into the end bedroom. As soon as I could get out, I went into the room, but no one was there. One of us always stayed with my mother, who was over 70, and one day when I was at home with her and the others were all out, she sent me to shut the windows as it was beginning to rain. My own room was the furthest off, and while I was in there, close beside me and quite plainly, I heard a deep sigh. That was not the only occasion on which I had heard things, and after we had left the house and confessed that she had asked me to sit on the bathroom steps and talk because when she was having a bath, the rustling lady would be about. She said she had seen the lady 3 times. twice going into a bedroom and once into the powdering closet. Once she had chased her into the bedroom, thinking it was the new charwoman going the wrong way, but when the lady reached the other door, she vanished. My mother and my other sister saw nothing and heard nothing, though the sister lived in the most haunted room. The lady we saw was supposed to be Lady de Lorraine, one of the Scrope family. The drawing room paneling was bordered with the arms of Berkeley and Scrope, and was said to have been passionately devoted to the old house. She was a plucky and vigorous woman, for they say that she threw stones out of the window at Cromwell's soldiers when they came to pull down Lincoln Cathedral. The death of Lord Hastings. A note explains that Aunt Maria sent me Miss Copley's account of Lord Hastings' ghost story. Aunt Maria was the wife of Henry III, Earl Grey. The Lord Hastings of the story was the fourth and last Marquess of Hastings, the notorious gambler who lost £120,000 over Hermit's Derby, which was a famous racehorse. He died in the following year overwhelmed with debts. It appears that Lord Hastings, before starting in his yacht for Norway, was entertaining at Donington a party of men, of whom Colonel Gordon, son of Lady Frances, was one. After dinner one evening, Lord Hastings suddenly got up from the table and rang the bell. When the servant came, he said, "Go and find out who has called at this time of night. I heard a carriage drive up to the door." After some time had elapsed, the servant returned and reported that there must have been a mistake, as no one had called, and there was no trace of wheels on the drive outside. Lord Hastings was apparently satisfied, but a few minutes later he jumped up again and rang the bell. "I've heard another carriage drive up," he told the servant on arrival. "Go and find out what it means and who it is." This time the servant was absent for still longer. When he returned, he said, "My lord, I have been round to the stables and everywhere. There is no sign of any carriage, and no one has called." Whereupon Lord Hastings threw up his hand and exclaimed, "Then I am a dead man before the end of the year." His companions at table thought his conduct very strange, some of them supposing that their host must have drunk too much. Noticing their surprise, Lord Hastings explained this conduct. There was, he told them, a tradition that when the head of the Hastings family, sitting at his table, twice heard a non-existent carriage drive up to the front door of the house, he would die before the end of the year. Next day, Colonel Gordon wrote to his mother. At the end of his letter, he asked, "By the by, is there any legend attached to the Hastings family?" He was careful to give no indication that he was referring to any particular incident that had happened. Lady Frances replied by return of post, "You asked about a legend in the Hastings family. Surely you must have heard that when the head of the house, sitting at his own table, twice hears a carriage drive up to the door, and no carriage is there, he will die before the end of the year." "I've told the story," added by Miss Copley, "as I heard it from C. Waldron. Only, I am not sure whether the carriage was to be heard by the head of the house only, or if the other guests, without knowing the story, also shared the delusion. If they heard nothing, it is possible that Lord Hastings was drunk, or if sober, was suffering from a bad conscience. When I told the story the other day, someone who was present and already knew about it added the information that Lord Hastings had taken a bet about his death." "With whom?" I asked. "With a friend, that he would not be dead, and he cannot lose. If he lives, he wins. And if he dies, he can't pay, nor need his successor, since debts of honor are not transferable. I can believe anything of him. The legend certainly exists. The scene in the dining room at Donington certainly occurred. There are still 4.5 months before the 1st of January, 1869. Lord Hastings died on November 10th, 1868. The Curse of 1,000 Kisses by Sax Rohmer. Introductory. Saville Granger will long be remembered by the public as a brilliant journalist and by his friends as a confirmed misogynist. His distaste for the society of women amounted to a mania, and to Granger a pretty face was like a red rag to a bull. This was all the more extraordinary, and for Granger, more painful, because he was one of the most handsome men I ever knew, very dark, with wonderful flashing eyes and the features of an early Roman, or, as I have since thought, of an aristocratic Oriental. Aquiline, clean-cut, and swarthy. At any mixed gathering at which he appeared, women gravitated in his direction as though he possessed some magnetic attraction for the sex, and Granger invariably bolted. His extraordinary end, never explained to this day, will be remembered by some of those who read of it. But so much that affected whole continents has occurred in the interval that to the majority of the public the circumstances will no longer be familiar. It created a considerable stir in Cairo at the time, as was only natural. But when the missing man failed to return, the 9 days' wonder of his disappearance was forgotten in the excitement of some new story or another. Briefly, Granger, who was recuperating at Mena House after a rather severe illness in London, went out one evening for a stroll, wearing a light dust coat over his evening clothes and smoking a cigarette. He turned in the direction of the Great Pyramid and never came back. That is the story in its bald entirety. No one has ever seen him since, or ever reporting having seen him. In the following story is an elaborate hoax, perpetrated by Granger himself for some obscure reason remaining in hiding, or by another well acquainted with his handwriting. I do not profess to say. As to how it came into my possession, that may be told very briefly. 2 years after Granger's disappearance, I was in Cairo, and although I was not staying at Mena House, I sometimes visited friends there. One night, as I came out of the hotel to enter the car which was to drive me back to the Continental, a tall native dressed in white and so muffled up that little more of his face than two gleaming eyes was visible, handed me a packet, a roll of paper, apparently, saluted me with extraordinary formality, and departed. No one else seemed to have noticed the man, although the chauffeur, of course, was nearly as close to him as I was, and a servant from the hotel had followed me out and down the steps. I stood there in the dusk, staring at the packet in my hand, and then after the tall figure, already swapping the shadows of the road. Naturally, I assumed that the man had made some mistake in holding the package near the lamp of the car. I examined it closely. It was a roll of some kind of parchment, tied with a fragment of thin string, and upon the otherwise blank outside page my name was written very distinctly. I entered the car, rather dazed by the occurrence, which presented several extraordinary features, and unfastening the string began to read. Then, in real earnest, I thought I must be dreaming. Since I append the whole of the manuscript, I will make no further reference to the contents here, but will content myself with mentioning that it was written with dark brown ink, in Saville Granger's unmistakable hand, upon some kind of parchment or papyrus, which has defied three different experts to whom I have shown it, but which in short is of unknown manufacture. The twine with which it was tied proved to be a finely plaited reed. That part of Granger's narrative, if the following amazing statement is really the work of Granger, which deals with events up to the time that he left Mena House and the world, I've been able to check. The dragoman Hassan Abd el-Kabir was still practicing his profession at Mena House at the time of my visit, and he confirmed the truth of Granger's story in regard to the heart of lapis lazuli, which he had seen, and the meeting with the old woman in the musky, of which Granger had spoken to him. For the rest, the manuscript shall tell Granger's story. Part 1. The Manuscript. 2 years have elapsed since I quitted the world, and the presence in Egypt of a one-time colleague, of which I have been advised, prompts me to put on record these particulars of the strangest, most wonderful, and most beautiful experience which has ever befallen any man. I do not expect my story to be believed. The skepticism of the material world of Fleet Street will consume my statement with devouring fires, but I do not care. The old itching to make a story is upon me. As a story, let this paper be regarded. Where the experience actually began, I must leave to each reader to judge for himself. I personally do not profess to know, even now, but the curtain first arose upon that part of the story which it is my present purpose to chronicle one afternoon near the corner of the Street of the Silversmiths in Cairo. I was wandering in those wonderful narrow winding lanes unaccompanied, for I am by habit a solitary being, and despite my ignorance of the language and customs of the natives, I awakened to the fact that a link of sympathy, of silent understanding, seemed to bind me to these busy brown men. I had for many years cherished a secret ambition to pay a protracted visit to Egypt, but the ties of an arduous profession hitherto had rendered its realization impossible. Now, a stranger in a strange land, I found myself at home. I cannot hope to make evident to my readers the completeness of this recognition. From shepherds, its throngs of cosmopolitan travelers, and its host of pretty women, I had early fled in dismay to the comparative quiet of Mena House. But the only real happiness I ever knew, indeed, as I soon began to realize, had ever known, I found among the discordant cries and mingled smells of perfume and decay in the native city. The desert called to me sweetly, but it was the people, the shops, the shuttered houses, the noise and the smells of the eastern streets which gripped my heart. Delightedly, I watched the passage of those commercial vehicles, narrow and set high upon monstrous wheels, which convey loads of indescribable variety along streets no wider than the hall of a small suburban residence. The Parsis and the Kalan Khalil with their carpets and shining silkware, the Arab dealers, fierce, swarthy tradesmen from the desert, and the smooth-tongued Kyrenes, upholding embroidered cloths and gauzy yashmak to allure the eye. All these I watched with a kind of gladness that was almost tender, that was unlike any sentiment I had ever experienced toward my fellow creatures before. Mendicants crying the eternal bakshish saks with their skins of Nile water, and the other 101 familiar figures of the quarter filled me with a great and glad contentment. I purposely haunted the mosque during the heat of the day because at that hour it was comparatively free from the presence of Europeans and Americans. Thus, on the occasion of which I write, coming to the end of the street in which the shops of the principal silversmiths are situated, I found myself to be the only white man, if I except the Greeks, in the immediate neighborhood. A group of men hurrying out of the street as I approached it first attracted my attention. They were glancing behind them apprehensively, as though at a rabid dog. Then came a white-bearded man riding a tiny donkey and also glancing back apprehensively over his shoulder. He all but collided with me in his blind haste, and stepping quickly aside to avoid him, I knocked down an old woman who was coming out of the street. The man, who had been the real cause of the accident, rode off at headlong speed, and I found myself left with a poor victim of my clumsiness in a spot which seemed miraculously to have become deserted. If the shopkeepers remained in their shops, they were invisible. They must have retreated into the darkest corners of the caves in the wall, which constitute native emporiums. Pedestrians, there were none. I stooped to the old woman, who lay moaning at my feet, and as I did so, I shrank. How can I describe the loathing, the repulsion which I experienced? Never in the whole of my career had I seen such a hideous face. A ragged black veil, which she wore, had been torn from its brass fastenings as she fell, and her countenance was revealed in its appalling ugliness. Yellow, shriveled, toothless, it was scarcely human, but above all, it repelled because of its aspect of extreme age. I do not mean that it was like the face of a woman of 80. It was like that of a woman who had miraculously survived disease for several centuries. It was a witch face, a deathly face. And as I shrank, she opened her eyes, moaning feebly and groping with claw-like hands, as if darkness surrounded her. Furthermore, I saw a new pain, and a keener pain, light up those aged eyes. She had detected my involuntary movement of loathing. Those who knew me will bear testimony to the fact that I was not an emotional man or one readily impressionable by any kind of human appeal. Therefore, they will wonder the more to learn that this pathetic light in the old woman's eyes changed my revulsion to a poignant sorrow. I had roughly knocked her from her feet and now hesitated to assist her to rise again. Truly, she was scorned and rejected by all. A wave of tenderness that cannot be described, that could not be resisted, swept over me. My eyes grew misty, and a great remorse claimed me. "Poor old soul," I whispered. Stooping, I gently raised the shriveled, ape-like head, resting it upon my knee, and bending down, I kissed the old woman on the brow. I record the fact, but even now, looking back upon its happening, and seeking to recapture the cold, solitary Seville Granger who had left the world, I realized the wonder of it, that I should have been given rein to such an impulse, that such an impulse should have stirred me, which phenomena was the most remarkable. The result of my act, regretted as soon as performed, was singular. The aged, hideous creature sighed in a manner I could never forget, and an expression that almost lent comeliness to her features momentarily crept over her face. Then she rose to her feet with difficulty, raised her hands as if blessing me, and muttering something in Arabic when shuffling along the deserted street, stooped as she walked. Apparently, the episode had passed unnoticed. Certainly, if anyone witnessed it, he was well concealed, but conscious of a strange embarrassment, with which were mingled other tumultuous emotions, I turned out of the street of the silversmiths and found myself amid the normal activities of the quarter again. The memory of the kiss was repugnant. I wanted to wipe my lips, but something seemed to forbid the act. A lingering compassion that was almost a yearning. For once in my life, I desired to find myself among normal, healthy, moderately brainless Europeans. along for the smell of cigar smoke, for the rattle of the cocktail maker, and the sight of a pretty face. I hurried to Shepherd's. Part 2. The same night, after dinner, I walked out of Mena House to look for Hassan Abd el-Kabir, the dragoman with whom I had contracted for a journey by camel to Saqqara on the following day. He had promised to attend at 8:30 in order to arrange the time of starting in the morning, together with some other details. I failed to find him, however, among the dragomans and other natives seated outside the hotel, and to kill time I strode leisurely down the road toward the electric tram terminus. I had taken no more than 10 paces, I suppose, when a tall native, muffled to the tip of his nose in white and wearing a white turban, appeared out of the darkness beside me, thrust a small package into my hand, and touching his brow, his lips, and his breast with both hands, bowed and departed. I saw him no more. Standing there in the road, I stared at the little package stupidly. It consisted of a piece of fine white silk fastened about some small hard object. Evidently, I thought, there had been a mistake. The package could not have been intended for me. Returning to the hotel, I stood near a lamp and unfastened the silk, which was delicately perfumed. It contained a piece of lapis lazuli, carved in the form of a heart, beautifully mounted in gold and bearing 3 Arabic letters inlaid in some way also in gold. At this singular moment, I stared harder than ever. Certainly the muffled native had made a strange mistake. This was a love token, and emphatically not for me. I was standing there lost in wonderment, the heart of lapis lazuli in my palm, when the voice of Hassan disturbed my stupor. "Ah, my gentleman, I am sorry to be late, but—" The voice ceased. I looked up. "Well," I said. Then I, too, said no more. Hassan Abd el-Kabir was glaring at the ornament in my hand as though I held not a very choice example of native jewelry, but an adder or a scorpion. "What's the matter?" I asked, recovering from my surprise. "Do you know to whom this amulet belongs?" He muttered something in guttural Arabic, replying to my question. Then, "It is the heart of lapis," he said in a strange voice. "It is the heart of lapis." "So much is evident," I cried, laughing. "But does it alarm you?" "Please," he said softly, and held out a brown hand. "I will see." I placed the thing in his open palm, and he gazed at it as one might imagine an orchid hunter would gaze at a new species of orchid. "What do the figures mean?" I asked. "They form the word Alf," he replied. "Alf? Somebody's name?" I said, still laughing. "In Arab it mean 1,000, he whispered. 1,000? "Yes, 1,000. "Well?" Hassan returned the ornament to me, and his expression was so strange that I began to grow really annoyed. He was looking at me with a mingling of envy and compassion which I found to be quite insufferable. "Hassan," I said sternly, "you will tell me all you know about this matter. One would imagine that you suspected me of stealing the thing." "Ah, no, my gentleman," he protested earnestly. "But I will tell you, yes. Only you will not believe me." "Never mind, tell me." Thereupon Hassan Abd el-Kabir told me the most improbable story to which I had ever listened. Since to reproduce it in his imperfect English, with my own frequent interjections, would be tedious, I will give it in brief. Some of the historical details imperfectly related by Hassan, as I learned later, I have corrected. In the reign of the Caliph el-Mamun, a son of Harun el-Rashid, and brother of the prototype of Beckford's Vathnik, one Sarwar was governor of Egypt, and the daughter of the governor, Shahrazad, was famed throughout the domains of the Caliph as the most beautiful maiden in the land. Wazirs and princes sought her hand in vain. Her heart was given to a handsome young merchant of Cairo, Ahmad Mahdi, who was also the wealthiest man in the city. Shahrazad, although an indulgent father, would not hear of such a union, however, but he hesitated to destroy his daughter's happiness by forcing her into an unwelcome marriage. Finally, passion conquered reason in the breast of the lovers, and they fled. Shahrazad, escaping from the palace of her father by means of a rope ladder, smuggled into the harem apartments by a slave whom Ahmad's gold had tempted, and meeting Ahmad outside the gardens where he waited with a fleet horse. Even the guard at the city gate had been bought by the wealthy merchant, and the peer succeeded in escaping from Cairo. The extensive possessions of Ahmad were confiscated by the enraged father, and a sentence of death was passed upon the absent man, to be instantly put into execution in the event of his arrest anywhere within the domain of the Caliph. exiled in a distant oasis, the sheikh, of which was bound to Ahmad by ties of ancient friendship, the prospect, which had seemed so alluring to Scheherazade, became clouded. Recognizing this change in her attitude, Ahmad Ermadi racked his brains for some scheme whereby he might recover his lost wealth and surround his beautiful wife with the luxury to which he had been accustomed. In this extremity, he had recourse to a certain recluse who resided in a solitary spot in the desert, far from the haunts of men, who was widely credited with magical powers. It was a whole week's journey to the abode of the wizard, and unknown to Ahmad, during his absence, a son of the caliph, visiting Egypt, chanced to lose his way on a hunting expedition, and came upon the secret oasis in which Scheherazade was hiding. This prince had been one of her most persistent suitors. The ancient magician consented to receive Ahmad, and the firstborn which the enamored young man craved of him was that he might grant him a sight of Scheherazade. The student of dark arts consented. Bidding Ahmad to look into a mirror, he burned a secret perfume and uttered a prescribed incantation. At first mistily and then quite clearly, Ahmad saw Scheherazade standing in the moonlight beneath a tall palm tree, her lips raised to those of her former suitor. At that the world grew black before the eyes of Ahmad, and he, who had come a long and arduous journey at the behest of love, now experienced an equally passionate hatred. Acquainting the magician with what he had seen, he demanded that he should exercise his art in visiting upon the false Scheherazade the most terrible curse that it lay within his power to invoke. The learned man refused, whereupon Ahmad, insane with sorrow and anger, drew his sword and gave the magician choice of compliance or instant death. The threat sufficed. The wizard performed a ghastly conjuration, calling down upon Scheherazade the curse of an ugliness beyond that of humanity, and which should remain with her not for the ordinary span of a lifetime, but for incalculable years, during which she should continue to live in the flesh, loathed, despised, and shunned of all. Until 1,000 compassionate men, unasked and of their own free will, shall each have bestowed a kiss upon thee, was the exact text of the curse, thou shalt regain thy beauty, thy love, and death. Ahmad Ermadi staggered out from the cavern, blinded by 100 emotions, already sick with remorse, and one night's stage on his return journey, dropped dead from his saddle, stricken by the malignant will of the awful being whose power he had invoked. I will conclude this wild romance in the words of Hassan, the dragoman, as nearly as I can recall them. And so he said, in his voice lowered in awe, Scheherazade, who was stricken with age and ugliness, in the very hour that the curse was spoken, went out into the world, my gentleman. She begged her way from place to place, and as the years passed by, accumulated much wealth in that manner. Finally, it is said, she returned to Cairo, her native city, and there remained. To each man who bestowed a kiss upon her, and such men were rare, she caused a heart of lapis to be sent, and upon the heart was engraved in gold the number of the kiss. It is said that these gifts ensured to those upon whom they were bestowed a certain possession of their beloved. Once before, when I was a small child, I saw such an amulet, and the number upon it was 999. The thing was utterly incredible, of course, merely a picturesque example of Eastern imagination, but just to see what effect it would have upon him, I told Hassan about the old woman in the Muski. I had to do so. Frankly, the coincidence was so extraordinary that it worried me. When I had finished, it was she, Scheherazade said fearfully, and it was the last kiss. What then? I asked. Nothing, my gentlemen, I do not know. Part 3. Throughout the expedition to Saqqara on the following day, I could not fail to note that Hassan was covertly watching me, and his expression annoyed me intensely. It was that compound of compassion and resignation which one might bestow upon a condemned man. I charged him with it, but of course he denied any such sentiment. Nevertheless, I knew that he entertained it, and what was worse, I began in an uncomfortable degree to share it with him. I cannot make myself clearer, but I simply felt the moral world to be slipping from under my feet, and no longer experiencing a desire to clutch as modernity as I had done before. After my meeting with the old woman, I found myself to be reconciled to my fate. To my fate? To what fate? I did not know. But I realized, beyond any shade of doubt, that something tremendous, inevitable, and ultimate was about to happen to me. I caught myself unconsciously raising the heart of lapis lazuli to my lips. Why I did so, I had no idea. I seemed to have lost identity. I no longer knew myself. When Hassan parted from me at Mena House that evening, he could not disguise the fact that he regarded the parting as final, yet my plans were made for several weeks ahead. Nor did I quarrel with the man's curious attitude. I regarded the parting as final also. In a word, I was becoming reconciled to something. It is difficult, all but impossible, to render such a frame of mind comprehensible, and I shall not even attempt the task. But leave the events of the night to speak for themselves. After dinner, I lighted a cigarette, and avoiding a particularly persistent and very pretty widow who was waiting to waylay me in the lounge, I came out of the hotel and strolled along in the direction of the pyramid. Once I looked back, bidding a silent farewell to Mena House. Then I took out the heart of lapis lazuli from my pocket and kissed it rapturously, kissed it as I had never kissed any object or any person in the whole course of my life. And why did so? I had no idea. All who read my story will be prepared to learn that in this placid and apparently feeble frame of mind, I slipped from life, from the world. It was not so. The modern man, the Seville Granger once known in Fleet Street, came to life again for one terrible, strenuous moment, and then it passed out of life forever. Just before I reached the pyramid, and at a lonely spot in the path, for this was not a Sphinx and pyramid night, that is to say, the moon was not at the full, a tall, muffled native appeared at my elbow. He was the same man who had brought me the heart of lapis lazuli, or his double. I started. He touched me lightly on the arm. "Follow," he said, and pointed ahead into the darkness below the plateau. I moved off obediently, then suddenly, swiftly, came revolt. The modern man within me flared into angry life. I stopped dead, and, "Who are you? Where are you leading me?" I cried. I received no reply. A silk scarf was slipped over my head by someone who silently must have been following me and drawn tight enough to prevent any loud outcry, but not so as to endanger my breathing. I felt like a madman. I knew, and the knowledge appalled me, that I was fighting for life. Arms like bands of steel grasped me. I was lifted, bound, and carried, I knew not where. Placed in some kind of softly padded saddle, or as I have since learned, into a shribier, or covered litter on a camel's back, I felt the animal rise to its ungainly height and move off swiftly. As suddenly as revolt had flamed up, resignation returned. I was contented. My bonds were unnecessary. My rebellion was ended. I yearned wildly for the end of the desert journey. Someone was calling me, and all my soul replied. For hours, as it seemed, the camel raced ceaselessly on. Absolute silence reigned about me. Then in the distance I heard voices, and the gait of the camel changed. Finally the animal stood still. Came a word of guttural command, and the camel dropped to its knees. Pillowed among a pile of scented cushions, I experienced no discomfort from this unusually painful operation. I was lifted out of my perfumed couch and set upon my feet. Having been allowed to stand for a while till the effects of remaining so long in a constrained position had worn off, I was led to forward into some extensive building. Marble pavements were beneath my feet. Fountains played, and the air was heavy with burning ambergris. I was placed with my back to a pillar and bound there, but not harshly. The bandage about my head was removed. I stared around me. A magnificent eastern apartment met my gaze. A great hall opened on one side to the desert. Out upon the sands I could see a group of men who had evidently been my captors and my guards. The one who had unfastened the silk scarf I could not see, but I heard him moving away behind the pillar to which I was bound. Stretched upon a luxurious couch before me was a woman. If I were to seek to describe her, I would invariably fail, for her loveliness surpassed everything which I had ever beheld, of which I had ever dreamed. I found myself looking into her eyes, and in their depths I found all that I had missed in life, and lost all that I had found. She smiled, rose, and taking a jeweled dagger from a little table beside her, approached me. My heart beat until I felt almost suffocated as she came near, and when she bent and cut the silken lashing which bound me, I knew such rapture as I had hitherto counted an invention of Arabian poets. I was raised above the joys of common humanity, and tasted the joys of the gods. She placed a dagger in my hand. "My life is thine," she said, "take it." And clutching at the silken raiment, draping her beautiful bosom, she invited me to plunge the blade into her heart. The knife dropped, clattering upon the marble pavement. For one instant I had hesitated, watching her, devouring her with my eyes. Then I swept her to me and pressed upon her sweet lips the thousand and first kiss. Note: the manuscript of Saville Granger finishes here.